Dark Prism is a dark anthology podcast featuring stories about the eldritch, the supernatural, and the horrific. Our stories may contain themes or imagery that some listeners may find disturbing. Somewhere in the barren wastes of North America, buried deep in the poisoned earth, amidst the winding corridors of a most unusual facility, behind countless concrete barriers and rows upon rows of iron and tungsten bars, sits a silent room. If one were to walk through the hall leading to this room, in the hallway, just outside its door, they may hear conversation, the scuttle of daily life, and perhaps even the occasional peal of laughter. But if you enter the room, the moment your toe crosses the threshold, in fact, all that noise will vanish. Should you choose to proceed into the depths of the chamber, you'll reach a lonely plinth with a shiny black stone set upon it. Look for but a moment into the swirling depths of its surface, and the silence is broken. And though the fluorescent lights may still blare above you, no light shall reach your eyes. Steel yourself and keep your gaze locked on the dark prism. Left turn. Next. The word hovered around in the air between thick margins of silence, sounding impatient and bored. When the guy at the front of the line moved, Roger was able to move a whole foot and a half forward. Not a whole lot, but a decent gain considering he hadn't moved a step in the last 5 minutes. If the man had been a real plump, say, maybe a type 2 diabetes kind of guy, he might have had a whole yard to play around with. He considered keeping it for himself, to separate the scant space between himself and the lady whose bra strap was his unwilling eye rest. Because the further he receded from her, the less his olfactory system would be overwhelmed with the melancholic scent of cheap, tulipy floral perfume. Roger considered it a scientific fact that time spent in the DMV passed twice as slowly as anywhere else. Roger Scott's theory of temporal unbearability, he would call it. This would be thrown into his collection of works with Roger Scott's piercings to mental health problems relativity and Roger Scott's women's age to bitchiness correlation. In the end, it would be a humble collection of works, but one he could be proud of, even if it only ever existed in the journal of his own mind. Roger's boredom reached its dull pinnacle at approximately 4:45 p.m., and he decided to abandon the line. He left the room of cluttered desks and vacant, glassy-eyed faces, and the unintelligible murmuring, the sound of people doing things they didn't want to, and he decided he'd better hurry. He was going to be late to catch LAER, wherein he would find out if Dr. Harper would transfer to another hospital, thus leaving the show without its primary antagonist, and make the show more likely to be dropped by its syndicate. Then he would have to find a new show, which would probably not be hard, but would take sufficient time to be annoying. Roger left through the unusually large building, not quite remembering which direction he'd come from, and so he chose a direction at random. At the end of the hallway, which came to a T, he turned left, and this was undoubtedly the biggest mistake he'd made in his entire mostly mediocre life. Marrying his first wife, who is now in an institution for the criminally insane, was Einsteinian compared to this small, seemingly inconsequential decision. So was the brief phase of tax fraud or even his piss-poor idea to try out for a local band, which only left him with a memory that he hoped, if he ate enough of those tiny pink packets of aspartame, he would have comfortably swept into the bin of Alzheimer's by the time he was 65. He turned left when he should have gone right, and would regret it for the rest of his life. Roger was not aware of even the more known outer edges of the corpus of Robert Frost's work, and so his embodiment of his advice was purely fortuitous. But since he didn't really care if he might have gone the wrong way, to say there was no adventurous whimsy involved wouldn't have been entirely true. Here, a man who looked a bit like Don Rickles when he still had most of his hair would have been seen disappearing through a wall at the end of a hallway that only turned right. As he strode down the narrow hall, Roger was now recalling the last installment of his show, trying to do a little mental catch-up. They'd have the last time on the show segment, of course, but he still wanted to review the previous events himself, just to make sure he wouldn't be lost. In the previous episode, a woman diagnosed with melanoma, he remembered, had discovered her cousin, who she'd never gotten along with, was coincidentally being seen in the room just next door. She, who had just found out that the lumps in her breasts were malignant tumors. These two, by the end of the episode, had mutually agreed to set aside their differences in light of their simultaneous diagnoses. And then there was Dr. Elway, of course, who had discovered she was pregnant, and who was debating whether or not to go ahead and get an abortion. Roger kept thinking of that ass in those tight blue hospital scrubs, like a ripe piece of fruit you just want to bite into. God, if he were 20 years younger, what he would do to a gal like that. Deb had a decent body when they'd first been married, but time and gravity, it seemed, had taken their toll. Not to mention those little Häagen-Dazs ice cream bars she'd sneak in from the grocery bag and into the back of the freezer. She thought he didn't know about it, but he did. Ever since he couldn't find the frozen corn one night and had instead found them up there, hibernating away in the dark like little animals. The thinly carpeted hallway Roger had stepped into was jam-packed with offices. It smelled vaguely of plaster rot, and everything, including the doors, was an ugly hue of beige, a color nothing on earth really is unless you force it to look that way on purpose. Nothing, he mused, except maybe pine nuts and the flesh of anemic European royalty. Absent-mindedly, he read a door as he went by that said, Jeremiah Hilburn, County Commissioner in black calligraphy, which, unlike everything else, looked brand new. As he peered beyond the text on the glass, he saw with vague, passing interest that the room seemed to be vacant of its metachronistically named appointee. Oddly, this held true for each door he looked through. Inside, there were all the indicators of use, computers, papers, coffee mugs, but no people. No real activity at all. No more happening here than one would find in any building in a Texas ghost town. He imagined big, scratchy tumbleweeds bouncing and rolling their way down the hall, not blown by any wind, but somehow moving on their own. He frowned. Why would he think of something like that? But he found he didn't care. He didn't give so much as a Frenchman's fuck about anything but getting the hell out of here. He approached the end of the hall, which again went left, with all noise now having receded around him aside from the faint and lackadaisical roar of the ventilation system. He wandered on, hoping an exit would be the next door he saw. Things, he thought, should not be this complicated, and when they were, it was only good and right that there should be people around to point you in the right direction. This is the reason this country's going into the shitter, he muttered with righteous bitterness, gritting his teeth and glowering at empty space. After seeing nothing of note in a doorless hall, he hooked around the third consecutive left turn, one which would have brought him back to where he had started if Euclidean geometry had any longer been relevant, but it did not lead him back to the DMV. Now all was rough and cement and huge, the floor, walls, and even the ceiling across which pipes stretched like metallic veins down the whole length, and it was dim. He glanced around, his eyes pale and reflective even in the low light. He mumbled to himself, though unconsciously drawing his voice back to almost a whisper. As if the silence were something he could anger. Did drunk monkeys design this goddamn place? Roger was mildly confused. He was not scared. here on this average sunny Wednesday afternoon in the middle of Kansas, but it just so happened that he should have been. He would have been right to have been in an utmost panic, in fact, but instead he just continued, noting to himself that when he got home he'd have a great big glass of wine and maybe open the new bottle. What was it called? De Rosé or something. It was odd that the place was, by all appearances, empty. But he figured maybe it was one of those second-hand holidays, like Columbus Day, and only some people got the day off. He hissed additional obscenities under his breath, picking up his pace once again. His footfalls echoed, his arch-support Hummels making much more noise than their padded appearance seemed to warrant. The pipes above his head made strange intestinal gurgling sounds. As he went along, for no real reason, a tightness clutched at his chest. But this was already more exercise than he usually got in an entire day, the most of which was typically comprised of walking to and from his car, climbing the stairs only to go back to sitting on his sofa. His breath was raspy in his throat, and he shook his head in disgust. On the right, he passed one of those big old Oscar the Grouch trash cans, the silver kind with divots in the side. And on the left, further down, there was a plexiglass window in the wall. The window was almost at the end of the hall, which would, of course, hook left once again. There was nothing else. Nothing at all. Not even an outlet in the wall or a wayward chair or anything oddly indicative of a habitable place. Finally, he'd had quite enough and decided he would stay here until someone showed up, chairs or not. As he approached, he saw it had a little bell placed just in front of the window, on a small surface that protruded out from the bottom. Roger crept closer and got a better look. He peered inside and saw that it was a small space, almost claustrophobically so, and it reminded him of those closed-in booths they used to have outside movie theaters, like the one back in Atchison, where he saw Close Encounters and Saturday Night Fever. There was a wraparound desk inside, a tan filing cabinet, and a door that led to some other room. He stuck out his finger, then hesitated. Some voice inside him, one that did not seem entirely his own, screamed for him to stop. It screamed at him to go right back the stupid direction he'd come from and never wander through unfamiliar buildings ever again. Then he tapped the bell. It sounded out shrilly and made him recoil. It was, he thought, twice as loud as it should have been. Oh, those fuckers in every industry, always making cars faster, TVs bigger, and now even finger bells louder. It made his ears ring in a crisp stereo for a moment, knocking his tinnitus into overdrive. Then it was quiet again, and he waited. No one came. He peered up and down the hallway and looked for anyone else who might have heard. When he saw no sign of life, he nearly salivated with disdain. The needle of an imaginary internal dial would have now been going clockwise past indignant frustration and on to anger. A heat rose in his cheeks. Was he suddenly the only person in the world?
Hello?
He rang the bell once more and knocked on the window, which made a dull, muted thudding sound. It was quiet as the bell was loud, and he wasn't sure which sound he liked less.
Hello? Anyone here? Hello?
In response, all he got was his words yelling back at him, as if he was being mocked by his own voice. The acoustics of the crude hallway made the echo sound huge, bouncing off the cement walls and extending the O sound of the word. Then the only noise was the pipes gurgling and hissing with passing water, as if they weren't pipes at all, but frozen snakes.
Jesus, Henry Christ!
Roger sighed and blasphemed to himself, and with as much resolute annoyance as he'd ever felt in his life, backed away from the window and rounded the next corner. When he stepped around the next turn, Roger had expected unconsciously to see another hallway, maybe even bigger than the last, stretching down and almost disappearing into its own darkening distance. He would not have made this assumption a few minutes before, that this building could contain such a spacious and lifeless corridor. But given the strange layout he'd just seen, the whole thing was starting to make an odd sort of sense. A nonsensical sense. A way of looking at things he'd slipped into just as easily as one slips between the sheets of his own bed. Some kind of whimsical unnormal was now becoming the new normal here, and he had hardly noticed it as it happened. He'd been elsewhere, thinking of... What had he been thinking of? With a creeping sense of unease, he found he could not retrace his thoughts. They were all jumbled and scrambled into nothing at all which could be remembered clearly, at least not in the moment. Instead, all that sat before him was an empty space, appearing as bland and sterile as everything else, and on the left, there was an elevator. It had no doors and was made of slate-gray metal that matched the cement. To Roger, it looked industrial, a kind of elevator used to move huge things. A lift, as the Brits called it. Inside were bright halogen bulbs that shone in searing white light and flickered periodically, casting its interior in a dubious glow that hurt his eyes. It was the first time Roger had seen one like this. There were no bars to hold on to, and the size was amazing. Somewhat interested, he approached it and peered inside. There was nothing to see. It was a big metal elevator. Mildly confused, even given his slight acclimation to the strangeness, he twisted his face into a grimace, and unaware he was doing so, held his breath, held it like he had just entered some kind of vacuum and was trying to keep the last bit of oxygen he had in his lungs. Roger was now vaguely aware that something wasn't right. It would have been hard to say exactly when it happened, but now it didn't matter. It struck him in an indistinct kind of way that none of this made sense. Everything here was crudely made and larger than it should have been, including the trash can, and there was the uncommon lack of doors. And there had been too many turns, hadn't there? But still, even considering these things, the forefront of his mind ultimately focused on his overwhelming desire to get home and sit down again and begin exploring the entertainment-brimming land of cable TV. He'd get home, have his wine, surf the endless channels, watch his hospital show, and go to bed. And by tomorrow he would forget all about this brief excursion into the oddly ample depths of his county's oversized courthouse. Before he could back away, he noticed, standing on the elevator, that a draft of air hit the underside of his face. From the crack between the elevator and the floor, it almost smelled like...
"Excuse me!"
A voice sounded out sharply from the hall. It didn't hold the faintest presence of grace or politeness. He jerked around, utterly startled, as if ripped from a spell of sleepwalking. He swallowed, trying to let his suddenly attained feeling of guilt pass, because, after all, there was no good reason for it. It was like he was trespassing. He had disobeyed no written signs, and was simply trying to find his way out of the building. He was not a child caught stealing candy or picking his nose. He was a grown man, an adult, thank you, who was about to find out just what the hell was going on here. But with trepidation he couldn't shake, he walked back to the booth, his hands feeling tingly with the beginnings of adrenaline. There was a woman standing there in the booth, as if she'd been there all along, but she hadn't. Of this Roger was quite sure, though at the moment he wasn't sure of much anything else. But no, she hadn't been there before. She must have... She followed him with her eyes as he rounded the corner, like she'd seen him through the wall. Her hair was jet black and looked hairsprayed in place, and obscenely shiny, appearing like more of a wig than something that had actually grown out of her scalp. Her lipstick was violet and looked sloppily applied. "Do you have a quarter for the elevator?" Roger was about to put on his best Fred Astaire, nice to meet you smile, and ask for the nearest exit. But now he stood there perplexed, his mouth slightly ajar. She stared back at him expectantly. Roger blinked. "Well, do you?" Roger, unsure of what she meant, gazed down at her deep blue suit, a shade of which struck him as stifling, the color of waves that might be above you as you drown, as you took in water and sank through blurry tides towards the ocean floor. On the left breast, there was something that looked something like a name tag, but it was blank. She began to space her words like she thought he was either stupid or hard of hearing. "Do you need a quarter for the elevator?" "A quarter?" He stood, still at an awkward distance from the booth for conversation, wondering why in Uncle Sam's free America you would have to pay for an elevator. As he approached the booth, he loosened his collar, which suddenly seemed too tight, even constricting. A sweat was breaking out on his forehead. He cleared his throat, the sound echoing strangely in the uncarpeted hall.
"Will the elevator take me to the way out? I'm just trying to find the way out of here."
She stared back, an impatient expression on her face. Still feeling confused and out of place, he fidgeted, rubbing his hands together.
"Yeah, that's the way out. You go down."
Oh, good.
"Do you need a quarter? The elevator takes a quarter." She stared at him again, right into his eyes, unblinking. There was something about her eyes he didn't like, because it reminded him of something. Roger wouldn't realize until a whole 5 years later what that thing was, upon recounting the story to a psychiatrist for the fourth time, finally making the connection. When he was a boy, around 5, his mother had gotten a wooden nutcracker dressed like a soldier. It had come with a bowl of walnuts. It had been on sale for Christmas, and she'd gotten it on a whim while out at Brooks Shopping Center in early December. The giant figure, too large and heavy to be a toy, had scared Roger so bad. He had more than one nightmare about it. His mother had subsequently thrown it out. Those painted on, bright and ever-staring eyes, for some reason, were the same as this woman's. Perhaps it was partially that her frequency of blinking was less than that of the average person's.
Yeah, I guess.
She sighed and turned to the section of desk to her side. She slid open a drawer which appeared to him to have no contents aside from one quarter, which looked brand new. Her movements were prim and graceful, like someone operating a delicate antique sewing machine. She pulled it out, her long maroon nails scraping on the wood, making an almost chalkboard surface grinding sound. Roger winced. She wheeled her chair back to the front of the booth, offering it to him through the square hole in the plexiglass. She stared at him again as she held out her palm. The coin glimmered wanly in the booth's pale overhead light. Roger took it eagerly, because he was eager to end the interaction. He grabbed it, and when he did, almost jerked his arm back. Her hand was surprisingly cold.
"Thanks,"
he said, and was about to add that the front had fallen off her name tag, but thought better of it. He clutched the quarter, which was also cold, and turned to go, eager to leave this woman as fast as he politely could. He could feel those eyes, which were bright but had no sparkle, burning into his back as he walked away. Now that he thought he was about to get out of Dodge, Roger was more relaxed and suddenly in a better mood. In addition, he was amused by the mundane novelty of a quarter-operated elevator. He'd never seen or even heard of such a thing. He went into the elevator without a second thought and found a metal plate where the buttons normally were. In the upper half of the metal plate was a small vertical slit, below which was a partially peeled and extremely worn sticker of a red arrow and a picture of a quarter, both barely visible. Roger looked down at the quarter in his hand and was momentarily taken aback. He thought for sure the coin had been in mint condition, but now he saw it was so oxidized that he could hardly see George Washington's distinguished profile. As Roger lifted the quarter, which had not warmed up in his hand at all, he thought of throwing a coin into a well and making a wish. And his wish was to get the hell out of here. The quarter clinked as it disappeared and fell somewhere, making a satisfying clink-clack sound as it went into some unseen slot. Immediately the elevator screeched and whimpered to life, vibrating, dropping slightly, then descending. As it did, the corroded whine of what must have been a massive pulley shrieked, as if angry for still being used. As the elevator began to descend, any trace of thought was now absent from Roger's mind. He was in a good mood now, but not really present, because he was still a man in a place only because he had to be, between one of life's tedious mundanities and another, similar to when he was in the shower, or his car, or on the toilet. There was nothing to think about. There was only his purpose, to find an exit. His face was blank like a vacancy sign. His mind had left the building. The elevator went down, scraping and whining, and then hit the bottom with a huge vibrating thump. Roger's face fell, like something wilting. His expression collapsed from one of content absence to one of slack-jawed unbelief. The pep in his step went away as if blown by a wind and was immediately replaced with alarm and guilt. Alarm, because outside of the elevator all was dark, and guilt, because for some reason, he thought he should have known this was a trap. His wife's scolding voice bounced shrilly into his mind.
What, were you born yesterday? An elevator that takes a quarter? They don't even do that shit in California, let alone nowhere Kansas. You need to get your head checked, Raj.
Checked good and thorough. Yes, he did, because he was imagining this whole thing. It was a crazy dream. He had fallen asleep sometime after leaving the DMV, and he was about to wake up in a waiting chair, and all this freaky shit would be over, filed away in the quickly shredded forget folder of his mind. He backed up a step and bumped into the back of the elevator, refusing what he plainly saw. No, this couldn't be happening. It couldn't. But it was. It was too vivid to be anything but real. Well then, he'd make the elevator go back up. He'd go back up, give that bitch a good talking to, and then go all the way back the way he had come. Then, he had the thought he wished he'd had before putting the coin into the slot. He'd only had one quarter, and there was no way back up. This had been a one-way trip. Roger's pupils dilated, and his airway did the opposite. He was not asthmatic, but even still, it felt like an invisible hand was having a good go at his trachea, and the sound of his breath was beginning to take on a markedly more wheezy quality. He did have sleep apnea, but he knew good and well that it couldn't be the cause of this. No, it was his fear. It had taken him over completely, and now was the one in charge, the one pulling the levers and making the calls. And that included charge over his body's autonomic functions. He needed to calm down, he told himself, to not let his rationality slip away from him, as it was already so willingly doing. He stood with his back to the hard metal wall of the elevator for a long time, feeling its cool, flat surface even through his thick flannel shirt. He could feel the sweat between his fingers and his heartbeat behind his ribcage hammering like it wanted out. He stood, clenching his teeth, and eyed the darkness in what was, in addition to his fear, mostly disbelief. And then, when his eyes adjusted to the darkness, his pupils, engulfing his eyes and making them almost as black as the shadows themselves, he began to see. The elevator lights still shone sparsely, and into, oddly enough, what seemed to be a well-furnished, carpeted living room. The light faded out not far ahead, but even in the mostly obscured distance, he could make out a sofa and a table with a lamp on it. The feeling of nonsensical sense reasserted itself, this time more strongly and completely. No, this wasn't normal, but it fit somehow, the way it might in a dream. And then he smelled something. It was what he had smelled from above for only a second, back up there when he was still cradled by his silly illusion of safety. Cinnamon? It was faint, but still. He would have sworn on anything the smell of cinnamon was coming from somewhere inside that room. For the first time in a few minutes, Roger dared to move. He crept a step forward, craning his neck and testing the air for what, for just a moment, he was sure had been a wonderful smell. Then, when it was swiftly replaced with the flatly acrid scent of mildew, he began to consider that it must have been his imagination. But then, there it was again. It was unmistakable this time. He inched forward to the mouth of the elevator, and ventured a scan of the room, one which belonged in a home, not the basement of a courthouse. Not unless this was some special VIP lounge where the paper pushers, judges, the cleaning crew, and the bailiff all got together to drink cocktails and gab about all the shitty townspeople. He peered, squinted, and tried to waft more of that delicious scent of marvelous spice into his nostrils. And then, with no warning, a light clicked on. As if someone had snapped a light switch into upright position, the room was flooded with a light. Right when the tip of Roger's nose passed into the room, he jerked backwards and his heart did a little trapeze flip inside his torso. He almost stumbled, then froze again, his eyes darting attentively around the small space. It was a normal living room, if not a tad retro. His fear was momentarily lessened, not dissolved completely, but temporarily turned down, as if with a volume knob. There was nothing harmful or sinister about the room at all. It looked warm and benignly welcoming. It was well furnished in its own way and appeared very comfortable. It reminded Roger of trips to his great aunt Edna's house when he was a small boy. There was a couch, an old, ugly pine needle green one that looked moth-eaten, but that fit the room perfectly. There was a wooden living room table, the Victorian kind, with curved legs that ended in animal feet. It was complete with coasters made of cork and a flowery centerpiece. Tulips, surrounded in marigolds, or hydrangeas, or something. There was a large recliner with pitted cushions, a curvy bureau made of pine, and a side table with a lamp. The walls were a repeating pattern of dark green vines that wormed their way around a vague mustard-yellow landscape, twisting in symmetrical patterns between each other. Altogether, it struck him as homey, and banal, if not a little fussy, but still, a normal room. The only thing about the room that was strange was that there was a door on the far wall, directly across from the elevator. This itself wouldn't have been strange, necessarily, but the room was arranged so that nothing blocked a clear path right down the middle of the room, into the door. And there, right above the door, was a big, glowing exit sign in blazing fire engine cardinal feather red. No, Roger corrected himself. It wasn't strange. This is still a courthouse. It hadn't been a trick, and that was the way out. Yes, this was just a lounge, a room for special events, and nothing unusual at all. Why would there be an exit sign if it wasn't the way out? The woman had said, "Down is the way out." Roger's morbid fear of some kind of inexplicable danger began to subside, and he felt silly for ever believing something was wrong. And then, there was the cinnamon smell again. Roger cracked a grin. Enraptured, he all at once decided he was going to explore this lounge. He was going to take an innocent little look around the room, like a TV sleuth, like Magnum P.I., and then he'd leave through the exit door. Curiosity killed the cat, he knew the saying went, but most people left out the second half. That was just as important. That satisfaction brought the same little furry feline right back. Roger was on the case. It was time to have a gander to see just what kind of senseless excess his tax dollars were paying for. He'd look, then leave, and that would be that. He padded with diminished caution into the room on a soft terrain of carpet that was somewhere between 70 shag and regular modern length. Even with shoes on, it felt soft enough to lay on, to swim in fact, or even to engulf his body and swallow him down into its hot, fuzzy, and stifling depths. This part of the courthouse is probably where all the government employees drink blood and fuck animals, he thought. He chuckled to himself. It was humorous, though he was simultaneously alarmed at the thought as it bubbled up, because for some reason, it didn't feel like a Roger thought. It was a few shades more morbid than those that were normally indigenous to his mind. Not by much, but enough to startle him. It seemed like a thought that had come from outside his mind and dropped itself right in quite suddenly.
Maybe it was just that it had more substance than a normal thought. Along with it had been a picture of a fat, naked guy holding a wine glass of deep red blood that splashed out onto his mustache as he drank. And as he peered eagerly at an underfed, scrawny-looking gray goat chained to the wall, he shook this strange idea from his mind with a strong effort and continued to observe. On the far wall, to the left side of the exit door, there was a large framed painting of some kind of sad, desolate farm scene. It made him more than a little uncomfortable to look at. The faces were all desultory, long and overtired, colored with sickly off-white brushstrokes in some kind of style that was not photorealism, but not quite impressionistic either. Pallid, slouching women in bonnets carried bundles of hay, and a man in suspenders held the reins of a horse pulling a plow, trudging with its head down. The sky above them was moody and deep gray with gloom. Forcing his gaze away from the piece, he looked over at the lamp, which was unplugged, and then to the recliner. It looked duvet soft and inviting. He walked right up to it and pulled the lever, making it collapse and recline. It made a minute squeaking noise and then a clunk. Seeing it unfolded, it occurred to him that it looked almost exactly like his recliner. It was only because it sat in a different room with different light that he hadn't seen it right away. Maybe, he thought, he'd just sit down on it and rest, just for a moment. If it were the same recliner as his, it would be just as comfortable. So comfortable. Just like the carpet, that he might even be able to take a little nap in it. The only difference is that he wouldn't be rudely yanked from slumber like he invariably would if he did it at home. The prospect was inviting. It had been a long day, and he'd been up since 6 to the sound of Deb raising hell on the phone with her sewing class buddy Margaret. Somehow, Deb had a way of doing noisy things, usually with her voice, at just the wrong time. It's almost like she was trying to wake him up on purpose. Roger left the recliner and approached the table, the one with the bouquet of flowers, searching for the source of that smell, cinnamon. It brought to mind cinnamon rolls, apple pie, and cozy winter days, and best of all, Christmas, full of joy, music, happy smiles, and gifts. Everything that one could love was all packed into that one savory, flavorful smell. Roger grinned again because he could smell it here, too. It was definitely stronger now. He gazed around the table's surface and felt the petal of one of the flowers to see if they were actually real. And they were. When he touched the petal of the tulip, it fell off, flopping silently down on the table. Oops. Roger swallowed. Even though it had been an accident, and damaging a flower wasn't a crime, it still seemed like an act of desecration, a violation. Then, just as he was about to call it quits and leave, something else on the table caught his eye. Next to the fallen red petal, there was a small, corrugated envelope sitting right by a transparent vase. He picked it up and found it wasn't sealed. He casually opened it and pulled out a small card with neat handwriting. On it was written only one sentence. You have been looking for a straw of hay in a mass of needles. Roger clenched his teeth. What it meant, he hadn't the faintest idea, but it didn't sound pleasant, like something in a fortune cookie. Though it was a simple statement, it struck him as an off-putting image, not to mention eerily cryptic. It also seemed, for some reason, though silly, that the you in the sentence was meant to address him directly. He slid the card back into the envelope and threw it back down next to the flower petal. He stared down at the table, suddenly feeling twice as haggard as he had when he had first come into this room. His eyes felt sore, as if he had been crying. He sighed and thought of his recliner again, one that, unlike the one in here, had a TV across from it. He really just needed to get out of here and go home. Plus, he was beginning to feel claustrophobic. Though it was furnished remarkably like a 1950s middle-class living room, there were no windows. He was starting to feel like Goldilocks, intruding in a place he had no justifiable business being in, just waiting for the three grumpy bears to arrive. Also, he had been reading someone else's mail, which, among other things, was a federal offense, and he decided it was best to keep his little peek into the envelope a secret. Before Roger could think anything else, a shrill noise sounded from somewhere, piercing the air and destroying the silence. Alarmed, and now extremely guilty, Roger jerked his head up and glanced at the source of the sound. It was coming from behind the exit door. The sound was immediately familiar, and then he placed it. Yes, he knew that sound. It was that series of odd, screechy digital noises a computer made when it was connecting to the internet in the dial-up days before the invention of Wi-Fi. Probably someone's ringtone out there in the parking lot, Roger thought. And anyway, it was high time he got going himself. He was already going to miss the beginning of his favorite show, so he might as well bust his butt to his car and at least make sure he sees the conclusion. There wouldn't be a rerun of the episode for at least a month. Roger walked over to the door and opened it, then felt his heart sink all the way down into his intestines. Beyond the doorway, there was no fresh air to greet him. No parking lot, no sky, and no little squirrels with twitchy tails. Instead, it was something which filled him with both puzzlement and alarm. It was the same room. Not another similar room, but the same room. It had the same furniture, the same painting, and the same table with the same flowers, and, of course, the envelope. The door at the other end was open, and beyond this lay more of the same room, repeated for as far as he could see. Like a man under hypnosis, Roger shuffled into the second of the same room, an expression of confusion stamped onto his face, making him look dumb, like someone who has just been slapped and is trying to catch his bearings. The smell was there again, but it was hard to believe he ever thought it was cinnamon. No, it was the smell of something horribly burnt, like hair held to the flame of a lighter. Simultaneous to this realization, in his left ear, the dial-up squawks and beeps pounded his eardrum. He didn't want to turn, to see what was actually making that god-awful racket, but unable to stop himself, he did. As if his head was on a swivel, his neck filled with ball bearings, he slowly rotated his head to the left and saw it. When he did, the muscles in his jaw went limp. Oddly, the thought that surfaced in Roger's mind was, "I always knew one day this would happen." It was a bird. Not just a bird, but a bird that had no beak, because it didn't have the head of a bird at all. It had the head of a man. It was perched on the lace-frilled lampshade, looking at him. Its feathers were deep sable like a crow, but they didn't shine in the light. They were the color of the sky at midnight. Roger felt as if he would shrivel with fright, but he was afforded no such luck. In fact, luck seemed to have been working against him this entire time. The voice of premonition in Roger, it seemed, had been silent up until now, just when it was too late. Or at least quiet, ever since he was about to ring that little metal bell. That voice, if it was anything more than pattern recognition, was the same voice that had told him once with scarily accurate serendipity to leave a beautifully raging house party, despite his having a good time, which happened to end up being 5 minutes before the cops had come to ruin the fun, arresting as many people as they could get into cuffs. The cops had shot past him, all blazing primary colors and screeching wails as he drove calmly in the opposite direction, like he had known all along exactly when they would come. It was also the same voice that had often told him here and there to stay away from a certain stranger, or that told him to get away from a particular car on the interstate. But where had it been in the last 10 minutes? It
stared at Roger with unblinking black eyes which glistened resplendently in the room's smoldering yellow light. Suddenly, it dropped down from the lamp and landed on the floor. Roger jumped backwards. It began to convulse and shake violently. Soon it was morphing like inky Play-Doh, swelling, bending, stretching, and getting bigger. Roger stepped back and slammed into the table, knocking the vase of flowers to the floor with a smash that he barely heard. All he heard was an odd power line thrumming, zapping sound as the thing shifted and bent into something else. Before him, it stretched into a massive snake, still with the head of a man, and then it peered at him and began to speak. "You smell like meat. What a treat, what a treat. It's time to eat, eat, eat. Thank you very much, but I have to go now." Roger whimpered, his voice half in a whisper, his face contorted into an ill smile. No, no, this wasn't real. It couldn't be real. He was hallucinating, having a dream after too much shrimp creel. Something, anything, but it wasn't real. He backed up another step and hit the corner of the sofa. Now he felt his mind beginning to fray, his sanity peeling itself apart bit by bit as the creature slithered towards him with bitter death behind its eyes. The notion of sunlight, right and left, up and down, and 2 plus 2 were all becoming fuzzier and ever more unclear to Roger in a swirling whirlpool of broken thoughts. The axioms of sanity were shrinking away in a cyclonic suction, becoming echoes of themselves, echoes that were receding rapidly and were almost gone. The creature, still getting nearer, raised itself up like a cobra and spoke again. Out of its mouth came a voice that was a cacophony of 1,000 tongues, all speaking at once. "God has abandoned you, and you are mine." Roger smiled wider, a rictus of pain that would have scared anything that was actually human, but he was the only human in a radius of space that was expanding. Something was about to happen to him. Something big. He felt like a dry leaf under a magnifying glass, getting hotter and hotter. All of the color seemed to be draining itself from the room, leaving only dim and horribly clashing hues of tan and gray. "I was just trying to find the exit," Roger whimpered, clutching clumsily at the chair behind him. It rose higher, its head drifting up like a balloon, the cavernous hatred in its eyes deepening, becoming bottomless before Roger was something that was only wearing a human face and only operating it in a rough, puppet-like way, because it didn't care what it looked like. It spoke again, its voice cold and devoid of all mortal emotion. "I am the exit," it boomed, leaning back and forth slowly like a praying mantis about to strike. "And there is almost here. It's coming. It's getting closer. Almost here." It moaned out the last word with an almost sexual pleasure, all the while inching closer to Roger, whose bladder had gone limp, and who would have had urine in his pants if he hadn't pissed in the courthouse bathroom 20 minutes before, a 20 minutes that felt like hours. "See," it said, not so much speaking as groaning, with deep, inhuman delight. It narrowed its eyes on Roger, not looking at him, but sending something towards him. Roger's eyes locked on his, and then he saw. Like a wave, a volley of insanity was rocketing in his direction from some oblique point of origin, some kind of unfathomably vacuous force mushrooming quickly and threateningly towards him. It was not alive in any normal sense, but it was a huge kinetic power, repulsive and putrid, like something burnt. It was a malignant force which, if it was allowed to spread, would transform the whole human world into a horrid, abrasive place, one which he now saw coming in a vision. A new world of sharp edges, dissonant colors, profound discomfort, confusion, and discombobulation. It would snuff out the sun and stars in a single breath, turn rivers to blood, and turn grassy hills into heaps of broken glass. There would be no more sleep, and only convulsion.
There would be thorns and no flowers and no food, and families would eat fiberglass insulation for dinner, whose teeth would become needles that stab their own mouths, and they would all somehow live just to suffer more in a place where suffering was all there was. The world would be a place of constant, violent noise, acidic smell, and with no purpose except to exist, ironically, only to pound its inhabitants over the head with how horrid it had become. Roger could not breathe, and only stood statuesque while this rapidly coming, changing power grew larger, looming with its intention in his mind's eye. It was ravenously greedy and very devastatingly real. To him, it seemed he had stumbled upon an actual natural force. Not gravity, electricity, or magnetism. It was unpleasantness in its purest, most potent form. It would steal the breath from his lips. It would dissolve the flesh from his bones. It would wilt all the plants for being near them. It wanted to trample. It wanted to entrap. It wanted to stain, to soil, sully, and corrupt all life. And to do so to everything and everyone. And even when it did, it would never be satisfied. Even after it had turned everything it touched into hopeless ruin, Roger was awestruck. It was almost beautiful, in a horrible, tragic way, in its breathtaking horridness. The force came at him like a thunderhead, with all the raw power that was all burnt and putrid and empty, sterile, rotten out, and pointless, but ever alive with the vitality of a possessed corpse. There was drool on his lower lip, and his body felt limp. From the primal, hot-blooded, opposable-thumbed inner depths of his mind came a scream, one that did not sound like the voice of Roger Scott, born in Ohio and raised Catholic. No. This was the agonized shriek of nothing that could ever, by fair estimation, be considered vaguely human. He screamed, and in his confusion and fear, took off in the wrong direction. "Here at last!" it croaked behind him as he ran into another photocopy of the same room. He could feel the vibration of the voice in his stomach. It sounded vast, arid, and empty. "Here at last, life is past! Here at last, life is past!" Roger ran, while in his mind his end-of-life credits rolled. The part of Roger played by some schlub who never really mattered, and who never really cared about anyone but himself. He would just be another person gone missing for no apparent reason. One of the thousands per year that just one day don't show up for work, and who never show up anywhere ever again. Lost and forgotten, like coins in a couch or lint in a dryer. There would be no more Roger, and there would be no one to inherit his house. And so it would be sold at an auction to the highest bidder, someone who couldn't care less about any of the contents owned by the previous occupant, except for the ones that could be sold for a lot of money. Who would be unaware he had been sucked and swallowed into a strange and timeless bedlam of nightmares come true. The rooms, or room, as he ran, were all identical, except they were getting progressively worse in some way. The colors began to burn and clash, and all to turn more to a rancid orange. The wallpaper grew scabrous and began to crack and peel, and the bodies of the people in the rural painting began to ghoulishly contort into things that looked like human spiders. Everything was obtaining a greasy, gelatinous look, like it was all plastic about to melt. The pattern on the walls was now a mottled gradient of Rorschach ink blots, all unnaturally stretched shapes, giant mutant moths and other warped winged things. The carpet grew longer and uglier, and even waved like grass in a wind. There was no wind, however. Only the voice of the creature, something worse than the devil, as powerful as God, screaming out behind him, jabbering, maundering. "You're pitiful, but fucking pathetic, shameful, tiny life of bland emptiness and putrid mediocrity will fuel the flames of the bottomless fire, the hollow hole that will and will always shine in its glorious light." It was almost all over. Tears began to stream out of Roger's eyes, making the infinite hall of retro decor rooms even more warped than they had already become. He started to blubber and babble, making no intelligible sounds in any language,
but only vague pre-linguistic glossolalia. The meaningless phonetic nonsense noise a baby would make. Spittle flew from his mouth, and his face looked like it was changing shape. His eyes gazed with hysterical fright into the infinite rooms ahead, the light becoming more horrible, more stained, casting everything in a sick, smoldering hue that danced on the walls with the reflection of frothing water, a color that belonged nowhere and yet somehow was. He was running ahead into some great suffocating power, like a universe-sized disease cloud that relished the agony of all that it transmuted into absurd, apocalyptic filth. He kept from room to ever-contorting and shriveling room, all turning bronze and ancient, atavistic and falling apart. He kept running, now with puke on his shirt, panting and screaming like a newborn baby. Behind him, he could hear and feel the Snake Man closing in on him, shrinking the distance between him and some bizarre fate he never could have dreamed of. Approaching the event horizon of the unearthly, somehow banal and suffocating, but potent horror, it was now completely inside him, and had completely broken his mind. In a crazed frenzy of hysteria, he began to giggle and to babble uncontrollably.
I could turn this into a sideshow. Sell tickets, he screamed. Do it for the price of one. Dinner and a show. I'll show them all. Eat my ass, Elvis Presley. I'll give them the show of a lifetime and fuck them for dessert.
To him, this seemed like the cleverest thing anyone had ever said. And he brayed with laughter, puking while he did, a thick spewing of regurgitation that splattered into his face and stung like hot, singeing acid in his eyes.
I'll wash the world in blood. The bloody world. Bloody fucking world!
In the deepening distance, the infinite series of rooms was going from dim to dark. Roger took one last glance back over his shoulder, seeing the abomination just behind him, its face contorted into a ripe smile of hunger, its eyes now nothing but dark holes which still saw. Roger would live this moment again, in his dreams, which would be nightmares ever onward, and which would plague the soft underbelly of his every waking thought. As the shadows closed in around him, he began to stumble, and then to fall, at what to him seemed an incredible rate of speed. When he did not hit the stringy carpeted floor, but only kept falling. Like a drop of water descending towards a murky pool, Roger fell and fell for what seemed like an eternity. Some strange, warm wind whooshed around him and whistled in his ears. He tried to scream, but nothing came out. Then, below him, he saw something getting closer. It was hard to make out, but it was getting nearer with alarming speed, a surface of some kind. With no wits left to brace for impact, he fell limply, like a marionette cut from its strings, and...
In the second level of the Maple County Courthouse, a mostly bald man named Avery Miller, or Judge Avery Miller as was his title, was walking with a handful of papers, some of which was photo evidence, to the main courtroom. There had been a big storm the previous week, and a gust of wind estimated at a roaring 63 miles per hour had blown over an old dead oak tree at the edge of a man's yard, and it had fallen and hit his neighbor's house. Judge Miller slid a paper to the back of his stack, preparing to preside, and approached the heavy courtroom door, one stained with a shiny lacquer in which he could see his faint reflection. Before he could reach for the handle, a loud crash sounded out from somewhere behind him, and a shockwave of alarm surged through his body and his heart, one which was kept in rhythm with a pacemaker, thumped with percussive force behind his ribcage. He spun around and was first shocked, then subsequently puzzled at what he was just in time to see. A man, one who looked like he'd been running through a hot rainforest, appeared to have just fallen out of the janitorial closet, and was lying on the ground with a mop, a broom, and cleaning supplies scattered around him. The man moaned something inaudible and writhed on the floor of thin maroon-colored carpet tiles. Miller stopped, furrowing his brow, and stood there for 30 seconds, watching him in disbelief. After becoming no less confused, he set his papers on a nearby waiting chair and approached. Before him, the man rolled onto his back, and Miller jumped backwards in alarm, almost stumbling, then caught his balance. The man's face was covered in a shine of perspiration and what appeared to be vomit, but this was not what shocked Miller. It was the look on his face. He had never in his life seen such an expression of absolute horror and anguish on the face of any human being. Trying to compose himself, Miller stood peering down at the wild-eyed man, being sure to keep a safe distance away.
"What the hell happened?"
The wild-eyed man didn't respond, and only moaned something which sounded like an Asian language, Cantonese or Mandarin. Mildly annoyed, the judge, who was used to asking questions, continued,
"What just happened? Why were you in the closet?"
The man turned his gaze towards him slowly, not really seeming to see him, and moaned. From the end of the hall, two people walked in their direction, one of them a security guard. Miller, still concentrating closely on the man's face, checked his watch, then continued his inquiry.
"Who are you?"
He worked his jaw for a moment, like a puppet. Then finally he spoke, and Roger Scott, who would be submitted into a mental institution the next day and die 6 years later in his sleep, gazed up at the bald man, and when asked his name, answered,
"I hate the wind chimes, sir. I don't think anyone hears them anymore."
He reached up and grabbed Miller by his robe's collar tight with one damp, trembling hand. Miller felt the sparkling mist of sour-smelling spit splatter onto the skin of his face and into his eyes.
"But they're talking to me. Talking, whistling, writhing, tendrils, whiskers, batty radar, tentacle suction, castrata stranglers. I'll fuck you. I'll fuck you right now. You know it. Everyone knows it. I forgot what I did tomorrow. And so do you.
Get the hell off me, you fucking loon."
"Fucking loon. A loon with a spoon at noon in June."
He grinned a repulsive grin and laughed more salivation and puke into the judge's esteemed face. Then let go and rolled onto his back in a fit of hoarse chortling that ended in a sputtering of coughs. Miller stumbled and crawled backwards, stood up, tripped on his robe, and fell down again. The security guard, a mustachioed man with biceps almost the size of Thanksgiving hams, reached Roger and flipped him onto his back, sliding his hands into cuffs with overqualified strength and expert agility.
"The rain in my brain makes me abstain. It's all shit. All day, all right."
As the man in uniform dragged the incoherently bellowing man towards the door, the hallway lights flickered for a brief moment, then stayed on. Once the man had been dragged outside, the few people that had been walking by and had stood and silently observing the commotion looked at each other, as if to confirm what they had witnessed wasn't to their imagination. Then they continued on, one of them shaking his head, and they all got back to whatever particular business had brought them here. Now everything seemed to go back to normal, and the world fell back into its regular rhythm of people doing uninteresting things. It was past 5 o'clock, and rush hour was well underway. Clocks ticked, phones rang, voices chattered, and everything went on as usual. The workday continued, to be endured in discomfort and then forgotten, like passing a kidney stone. The judge collected himself, stood up, then looked down at himself, disgusted at the speckles of vomit on his black robe. He hissed an angry breath through his teeth and wiped the sweat from his forehead. He needed to go to the bathroom and wash up before he went into the courtroom. He couldn't very well walk in there looking like this in front of all those people, and more importantly, Deputy Anderson, who would be present. Miller was new to the area, and this was only his second time in the courthouse. Bathroom. Where was the bathroom again? He turned and went down a hall, one the end of which split to a T. He didn't remember this part of the building, but then again, this was not strange, because he had very little of its inside memorized thus far. This was, perhaps, the most oddly designed and complex building he'd ever been, or at least worked inside of. At least since his clerkship in Jacksonville back in the mid-80s.
That place had been big, sure, bigger, but aptly sized for the metropolis in which it sat and served. This place was almost nonsensically big for such an unimpressively medium-sized city.
Boy, they must rake in a whole lot of tax money around here, he mused.
After pausing at the end of the hall and deliberating, Miller turned right. Yes, this was the way. The last door on the left. No, wait. Miller had gotten about 10 steps when he stopped again.
Was this the way to the men's room?
He didn't think so. Not anymore. He stood there for a long moment, his gray speckled eyebrows furrowed over the pale blue searching beads of his eyes.
Ones which did not recognize anything they saw here.
No, he must have turned the wrong way.
He did an about-face and set off in the opposite direction, entering the hall he would have if he'd just turned left in the first place. As he walked, he thought he smelled something. Under the scent of old mildew carpet, under that dusty smell of ceiling tiles, the big stained blotched ones above him, which were probably old enough to be made of asbestos. It had been faint, but it was a nice smell, a good festive scent. Made him think of wintry pine trees, spicy candy, and for some reason, big fuzzy sweaters. Making his way down the hallway, he figured someone must have a big bowl of potpourri nearby, or maybe a candle, because he smelled something so positively wonderful that he even felt a little lighter on his feet. Helpless against its charm, he cracked a grin, a private smile which looked a little goofy on his usually serious face. What was that smell? Cinnamon?
This story was written by David Moss. Music by I'm your narrator, John Dodd. You can find us on Twitter X at Dark Prism Cast or on YouTube at Dark Prism. You can also email us at darkprismcast@gmail.com. Thank you so fucking much for listening. Take care of yourselves and take care of each other.